Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello, and welcome to the first ever episode of Chronicles. I'm tremendously excited to bring you the start of this series. It's one that I'm incredibly excited about because during this series, we're going to go through plays, we're going to talk about novels, we're going to talk about epic poems, as we'll be starting with today. And I'm going to attempt to explore a whole range of different forms and themes from across the Western canon, really. We're going to look at ancient Greek tragedies, ancient Greek comedies. We're going to look at Renaissance theatre. We're going to look at Charles Dickens novels, Shakespeare, or, as I chose for this particular episode, Beowulf. And of course, mine is the Tolkien translation. What else did you expect? And the reason that I chose Beowulf is because it's one of the most precious inheritances of the English people. There are very few works of literature from the Anglo-Saxon period of English history that have really survived and managed to be passed down to us, and Beowulf is one of those few exceptions. And in fact, Beowulf itself very nearly suffered a similar fate to many others that we probably don't know about and never can know, that have just simply been lost to time. The Beowulf story in its original form was in the alliterative style of Old English, Early Germanic poetry, which meant that each line was split into two halves that had similar phonetic weight. And Tolkien very cleverly once described this style as more masonry than music, although I suspect that a particular reason for why it had this alliterative style was because during the pagan years of the early Germanic and Nordic cultures, of course, all of their stories were transferred orally through storytelling and through the spoken word. And in having words with that phonetic punch and with that particular structure, it was probably easier to, you know, cast them to memory. The tale was found originally in the Noel Codex, which was a compendium of about five stories. And the Beowulf legend in particular is generally accepted to have been written in its form in the Noel Codex from around 1000 AD, though undoubtedly the story itself is much older. It would have been most likely that the original Beowulf legend was written in the Codex by a monk, because of course during that time it was the monks of the Anglo-Saxon monasteries that were by far the most literate and educated members of society. Though nothing conclusively can be decided, so the author of the poem is known in academic circles today simply as the Beowulf poet. Down the centuries, this codex of stories came to be in the possession of a gentleman called Lawrence Nowell, which is where the Nowell Codex gets its names from. And his signature can be found on the first page of it. Nowell was a scholar during the period of Tudor England, and he accrued a great deal of antiquarian scriptures and parchments and old legends from ages past. Eventually, this codex managed to find its way into the hands of a Sir Robert Cotton, who was an MP at the start of the 1600s, and like Nowell before him, a collector of antiquarian texts, tomes, and other such items. Sir Robert placed the codex containing Beowulf into his library at Ashburnham Place, and around a century later, the house decided to just live up to its name by catching fire. And in the frenzy of those flames, the original Battle of Maldon was reduced to ash, lost for all time. But fortunately, a copy had already been made of that, so we still have it to this day. But if Beowulf went up in cinders right there and then, we would not have it today. As far as we know, that was the only copy that anyone in England actually possessed at that time. Some Georgian hero threw the manuscript containing Beowulf from the window, and with the fall, you know, putting out the flames as it fell. And you can see, if you have photos of it today, how nearly we lost it. And it was just remarkable relief that we actually had it saved. You know, can you imagine a world in which we didn't have Beowulf? That's not really one that I particularly want to contemplate. So, fortunately, I don't have to. And after surviving the fire, Beowulf was eventually copied, thankfully, and then finally translated into English, modern English that is, and published properly at the beginning of the Victorian era in 1837. Upon its publication, it naturally attracted a lot of attention amongst academic circles and, you know, from Victorian scholars. And from them, Beowulf offered up a tantalising look into pagan Norse societies and also how Christian Anglo-Saxon England was reconciling with that part of its history, with that part of its past. They were able to cross-reference it with a lot of other historical accounts, such as there is one particular chronicle from a Frankish historian called Geoffrey of Tours, and in his Historia Francorum, which gives an account of a skirmish between some Northmen and the Frisians in the early 6th century. And a similar battle is described towards the end of Beowulf between King Hygelac of the Geats and his Frisian foes. And so, though we, again, can't know for certain, all of a sudden, a bit like with Herodotus, all of these things that doubt was cast on whether or not they actually happened, well, now we had another historical document by which to cross-reference some of these things with. It also gave some generous insights into what may or may not have happened during the civil wars of the 6th century in Sweden between the Geats and the Swedes, with, of course, the Swedes naturally emerging victorious because they were the ones who eventually went on to name the country. But aside from its historical worth, generally, the story wasn't held in particularly high regard. It was thought of as quite basic, poorly structured. Really, its value was purely in its existence as an historical artifact, rather than based on any merit to its actual literature. That was until 1936, when a very esteemed scholar and professor, who went by the name of J.R.R. Tolkien, gave a seminal lecture called Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics. And he put the emphasis on battling against the monsters and how vital that was to our understanding of the lives of these people who lived over a millennia ago. Because the thing was that the monsters were very disappointing to the Victorian historians and academics, and it was really Tolkien's scholarship that shifted academic opinion around to appreciating it as an actual piece of literature. Though, as is the case in bursting any long-held academic consensus, this didn't happen overnight. But it is largely due to Tolkien's love and fascination with this old poem that has battled against all odds to even still be around over a millennia after it was penned, that we treat Beowulf with the serious literary weight that it actually deserves. So, without further ado, let us begin exploring Beowulf and considering how special it actually was. So that we're all on the same page, though, it makes sense to first give a brief outline of the actual plot, and this is where I've chosen a few extracts from the text to read. The poem begins not with its protagonist, but instead with a warrior known as Shield, who was the founder of the Great House of the Shieldings, that is, the descendants of Shield. His progeny go on to become one of the great tribes of Denmark, and this is what the story says of him. Lo, the glory of the kings of the people of the Spear Danes. In days of old we have heard tell how those princes did deeds of valour. Oft Shield Sheffing robbed the hosts of foemen. Many peoples of the Geats, many peoples of the seats where they drank their mead, lead fear upon men. He who first was found forlorn, comfort for that he lived to know, until all that dwelt nigh about, over the sea where the whale rides, most hearken to him and yield him tribute. A good king was he. It goes on to tell of how Shield had a son named Beau, and that thus doth a young man bring it to pass, with good deed and gallant gifts, while he dwells in his father's bosom. But after in his age there cleave to him loyal knights of his table, and the people stand by him when war comes. By worthy deeds in every folk is a man ennobled. Eventually, four generations hence from Shield comes Hrothgar, king of the Shieldings, who like his forefathers rules ably and well. But this land is not at peace. One day, a creature named Grendel, a descendant of the biblical Cain, comes with malevolent evil to haunt the mead hall of Heorot. In the unrest of nights unknown, murdering, disemboweling, and even cannibalizing the victimized Shieldings. Rumours of this terror are carried across the sea on the ships of traders, until these tidings reach the ears of Beowulf, son of Ecgtheow. Beowulf is a member of the royal house of the Geats, and upon hearing of Grendel's terror, he and a small host of warriors cross the sound in their ships until they arrive at Hrothgar's land. Beowulf seeks an audience with the king, and Hrothgar, in his wisdom, is not too proud to rebuff Beowulf's offer of help. If the young man succeeds in vanquishing Grendel, then renown, glory, and wealth will be his. Beowulf's arrival brings hope to the Shieldings, and it is written that ever and anon the minstrel sang clear in Heorot. There was mirth of mighty men, no little assembly of the tried valour of Danes and Vedras. It's here that a jealous and somewhat drunken warrior of the hall, Unferth, son of Ecglaf, speaks as the one solitary voice of discord in the hall, not wishing for the outsider's help. He questions Beowulf's competence, given that he had once heard that this alleged mighty warrior had in fact lost a swimming race several years ago. But Beowulf, in control of himself and confident in his own prowess, explains that it was true that he lost the race, but only because he had had to engage himself in the battle with a savage sea monster, which he naturally eventually defeated. And eventually, after much revelry and music, night descends, the music dies, and Grendel comes. He enters the mead hall, brutalizing and then devouring a soldier. He then approaches the bed of Beowulf, who, feigning sleep, grabs him by the arm with such tenacity that even Grendel, with his inhuman and hellish strength, cannot break free. the folk of Heorot jump to arms and Grendel is smited and slammed by the flurry of their swords. But their blades cannot damage him. All the while, Beowulf continues to tear at his arm, a grievous hurt of body that fierce Slayer and Dire now endured. A mighty wound was seen upon his shoulder. The sinews sprang apart, the joints of his bones burst, and Grendel's limb is torn asunder from his body. Mortally wounded, he skulks off back to his lair in the fens, and evil is driven from Hrothgar's hall. Beowulf presents the arm to the Shielding's king, and after much gift-giving and honouring, the hall erupts into revelry. Everything seems resolved, but then Grendel's mother comes in vengeance. Though alas, Beowulf is not there to face her, having been quartered elsewhere that night. In the morning, the king once more beseeches Beowulf to destroy the mother, telling him, "Now, once more doth hope of help depend on thee alone." Beowulf is told of where her den may be, and Unferth, more soberly than before, gives him a sword, in deference to Beowulf's proven might, and renounces his own chance for valour. So, Beowulf tracks her to her cave, and does battle with this feral she-wolf. Her blade nearly claims his life, but eventually he grabs an old, mighty sword, cleaving off her head, and then takes the head of Grendel's corpse as a trophy. He returns to Heorot in triumph, to the jubilation of all. Hrothgar bestows many gifts upon him, including 8 horses, many marvellous riches, and even adopts Beowulf as his son. But with peace restored and glory won, it is now time for the Geatish prince to return to his people. And so he sails back to Sweden and recounts the tale of his adventures to Hygelac, his king. The story then leaps forwards about 50 years, and we now found Beowulf not standing before the king, but the king himself, old and wise, but still with that same spirit and strength that possessed him in his youth. He's ruled long and he's ruled well, but now, in the twilight of his life, he must face a menace more terrible than any he had previously reckoned with. A dragon. It slumbers atop of its hoarded wealth in unchallenged pride. But then, a thief finds a secret passage into his dominion and steals a jeweled cup. In its tantrum, the dragon soars about the Geatish lands, immolating its hall and eviscerating its homes. Beowulf gathers a small host of warriors to confront the winged beast, but in that crucible of fate, Beowulf's age hinders him, and the men he chose to support him cower in terror. Only Wiglaf, the youngest of their company, intercedes on his behalf, and together they vanquish the dragon. Yet, for Beowulf, the old king, the hardened warrior, it's too late. The dragon's venom has mingled in his blood, and his wounds are grave. He beseeches Wiglaf to show him a small sum of the treasure, that he may know what wealth he has won for his people, and may depart from life in peace. Upon seeing a portion, the aged warrior in anguish says, "Now that I have for the hoard of precious things bartered the span of old life, do ye henceforth furnish the people's needs. No longer may I remain. Bid ye, man renowned in war, to make a mound for me plain, to see when the pyre is done upon the headland out to sea." He says that it shall ever be known as Beowulf's Barrow, and naming Wiglaf king, the tale ends with Wiglaf angrily scorning the other men for their weakness and faithlessness, before ordering that Beowulf's Barrow be made. And a sense of foreboding doom clings to the story's end, as without their aged king, the Geats will no longer have the strength to defend themselves against the Swedes and other clans that wish to exploit their recent sorrows. In this way, the poem is more of an elegy than an epic, looking back in lamentation at one of the proudest warriors of its people. It has been said of Beowulf itself that its weakness lies in placing the unimportant things at the centre and the important things on the outer edges, so Tolkien commented regarding the discourse around Beowulf when he decided to change the discourse back in 1936. What he means by this is that the three bouts of action within the story, first against Grendel and then his mother and lastly the dragon, at the foreground and overwhelm the moments in the Mead Hall where more cultured curiosities, such as mentions of Sigmund and speculative details regarding the civil wars of Scandinavian peoples lay. However, my personal opinion is that it's these calms and revelries within the Mead Hall that balance out the action perfectly, as it's in those calms that you discover why Beowulf, and indeed all men, fight in the first place, to preserve what they believe to be the good. Heorot, that remarkable mead hall of King Hrothgar, is order, culture, community, and safety. Tolkien compares it to Camelot because of its both historical and mystical components combined into one. And it's remarkable as well that only very recently, back in 2013, a team of archaeologists, led by a chap called Thomas Christiansen, directed an investigation at Lejre in Denmark, excavate and date this late 5th, early 6th century building, which was most likely the first royal hall. And it seems to be the very hall that was attributed to Beowulf, the legend, the Heorot from Beowulf's tale. And you can just imagine this place in those dark ages brimming with life and culture and vitality, and juxtaposing that with the outside, with its untamed, unknown regions of the wild. It's easy to understand why those people might have thought that demonic forces were actively seeking to threaten that peace. But in that battle for order against chaos, Beowulf establishes himself as a very archetypical example of the warrior from the pedigree of Germanic heroic legend. Beowulf's ambitions for glory and honour are inextricably linked with his goodness. You cannot have honour without loyalty, and you cannot claim glory without heroism. And fortunately for Beowulf, his enemies are not characters of any moral complexity. Even though he does fight other mortal men in more traditional warfare during his life in Frisia and Sweden, this is not the focus of the story. Therefore, the poem avoids the moral grey of human conflict as found in other texts such as the much more ancient Iliad. In a further comparison to the ancient Greek tradition, the American writer R.W. Chambers observed in his Beowulf and the Heroic Age, comparing Beowulfian monsters to those of ancient Greek legend, Odysseus is struggling with a monstrous and wicked foe, but he is not exactly thought of as struggling with the powers of darkness. Polyphemus, by devouring his guests, acts in the way which is hateful to Zeus and the other gods. Yet the Cyclops is himself god-begotten, and under divine protection. The fact that Odysseus has maimed him is a wrong which Poseidon is slow to forgive, whereas the gigantic, monstrous foes whom Beowulf has to meet are identified with the foes of God himself. And this is integral to understanding the nature of Beowulf, given that it was most likely a story that was first majoritively, if not entirely, pagan in its conception. Because the Scandinavian and Germanic heathens not only had no quarrel with the existence of various mythological creatures, such as giants, ogres, elves, dwarves, and other such creatures that we now commonly associate with fairy tales, but their entire worldview hinged upon their existence, with creatures such as Fenrir the wolf and Jormungandr the world serpent playing integral roles in the fate of Midgard. With the Saxon conquest of England, many of these beliefs in giants and elves took root on our island and it was a task of the Christian missionaries to suffocate these superstitions. But it's clear that these folkloric creatures continued to persist in the minds of the common folk, and so in setting Beowulf to parchment, it becomes necessary for the Beowulf poet to create some reconciliation on two particular points. Firstly, where can the monsters in Beowulf come from a Christian perspective? And secondly, should paganism be wholly condemned, and by extension, the deeds and bravery of the Anglo-Saxons' Germanic forefathers be disowned? The first point, we've already established from the text that the poet devised a theological explanation out of the sins of Cain for why such monsters exist in the world of Beowulf. Not only is the writing for the battles brimming with vitality and vividness, but they represent absolute good conquering absolute evil, whilst simultaneously staying within the Germanic heroic tradition. Grendel is a monster, a descendant of the biblical Cain, who slew his brother Abel and became the first murderer. He is a damned and deformed creature. Not only is he cursed to bear the sin of his ancestral sinner, but he also commits sin himself. And Grendel's defeat brings on the wrath of his mother. Now, Grendel's mother is a very interesting character because she squarely fits into the chaotic feminine archetype. She lives out in the fens, in the wilds, and is in many ways a typical example of that den mother. There is no morality built around her. There is only mere survival. And she represents an existential threat because of her ability to give birth to more monsters, to brood more spawns from the descendants of Cain. And therefore, with new life that she brings into the world, she will continue to bring more terrors and more evil along with her. She's described numerous times, depending on your translation, as monstrous and she-wolf. And it's clear that every aspect of her character could only really be described as feral. But then comparatively, if you were to juxtapose her with the other most significant female character within the story, which is Wealthiar, who is the wife of King Hrothgar of the Scyldings, and she brings that more positive feminine quality. She brings healing and reconciliation. And this is seen by the fact of when she passes the mead cup around the hall and between different people, which is obviously a very old tradition in Germanic societies for creating bonds of social harmony and friendship when two men drink from the same cup. And so against the destructive vengeance of Grendel's mother, Wealthiar manages to bring some nurturing order that is wonderfully compatible with the social order that the men also reinforce in society. And then I suppose it actually just makes sense now, having spoken about Grendel and also his mother, to speak about the third monster that Beowulf actually has to grapple with in the story, which is of course the dragon. And what's interesting about the dragon is it's actually one of the monsters in the story that does actually have some basis in biblical scripture. Because according to Book of Revelation 12 through 9, it states that, "And the great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him." So whether or not Satan turns into a literal dragon or a metaphorical one, this goes a long way in biblical history for why we in the West have a conception of dragons as tyrannical, bloodthirsty, and merciless creatures, which is in total contradiction to the more Eastern cultural perceptions as dragons as omens of wisdom and good fortune and wealth and prosperity. And so if a dragon is by its very nature satanic, then that naturally also means that it is an inversion of Christian morality itself. And so the dragon represents the heroic but bent towards evil. both Beowulf and the dragon are strong, proud, and have great wealth, but with the dragon, these are corrupted into negative qualities such as greed and malice and destruction. It's one of the very interesting facts of the text of Beowulf that the theme of gift-giving is given such prominence within the text. Beowulf gives gifts and is given gifts by Hrothgar and by Hygelac. Even Unferth, the man who originally scorns Beowulf and mocks him and is suspicious of him, when Beowulf goes to fight Grendel's mother, Unferth gives him a sword, which is Hrothing. And though this sword is not actually effective against Grendel's mother, it is symbolic between Beowulf and Unferth of a token of goodwill, that Unferth actually wants Beowulf to go in safety and protection. Whereas when you look at the juxtaposition of this sharing of riches, this sharing of wealth, this sharing of gifts that happens in the civilized world of Heorot's Hall, compare that with the dragon's plunder, where the loss of but a single jeweled cup results in the dragon breaking out into wrathful vengeance, because what it's actually threatened by is the fact that one single person decided to challenge its supremacy and its dominion. And also, what's more, unlike Grendel and Grendel's mother, the dragon represents a more existential and timeless elemental threat, because the wealth on which it sits, the very hoard of the dragon, is the accruement of generations and generations of wealth by a race of people who no longer exist. There's a wonderful part before Beowulf's confrontation with the dragon where it's explained to the reader how this wealth came to exist in the first place. And it's essentially, as I say, the accumulation of centuries of wealth from a forgotten people. To go back to the point about the inversion of morality between Beowulf and the dragon, where Beowulf uses his strength in order to achieve valor and honor, which, as I said previously, only comes from righteous action that is used to defend the innocent. And it's very interesting, actually, in Tolkien's particular translation of it, he often uses the word knight, which, even though, of course, is anachronistic and there weren't knights in a pagan Norse society, because the idea of being a knight is obviously fundamentally a Christian concept. That's Tolkien just making a stylistic choice. But fundamentally, he is driving at a commonality between those two virtues, that what Beowulf is doing is protecting the innocent, protecting those who cannot defend themselves, and doing it to restore peace and order, whereas a dragon only uses its violence and its might for intimidation and towards the domination of others and terror. But fundamentally, Beowulf's battle with the dragon is during his old age. It's during the final years of his life. And even though the poem isn't symmetrically weighted, it's really a story of a warrior's rise and fall. And in Beowulf's struggle with the dragon, what he's actually symbolically doing is fighting against his own mortality. And in the end, it requires Wiglaf, the youngest of his company, to help him vanquish the dragon, because Wiglaf embodies that vitality and spirit and capability that Beowulf himself once exhibited during his earlier years when he was able to vanquish Grendel. It's also worth mentioning as well, actually, as regards to how the dragon comes to destroy Beowulf's kingdom through the firestorm, that it was all started by this particular thief. And the thief is a single mysterious character in this tale. It also reinforces the original point that has first been made by Grendel and his mother and the dragon itself, which is the thief clearly exists as someone apart from society, and how someone with a sense of greed and carelessness can unleash a chaos. And this is perfectly balanced out by the general structure of the poem itself, how there is peace and there is a battle, and then there is another peace and then there is a battle. And then this way you can see the pagan Christian understanding of that cyclical view of history, that peace is never permanent and that fundamentally life is one big battle. You might achieve, as Beowulf achieved, countless victories in your life, but eventually time waits for no one and it will conquer all, whether it be in the deathbed or whether it be on the battlefield. And it will be up to the next generation to come into their own and preserve that good that the elder generation once fought for. And there is another aspect to memory with the character of Wiglaf, who saves, well, doesn't save Beowulf, but certainly is able to help him defeat the dragon, so that Beowulf is able to at least have some final words and to be able to die his conscience in relative peace that his people are going to continue. Which is the fact that with Wiglaf remembers all of the gifts and honours that Beowulf has bestowed upon him through the years, and his scorn is rightly put on these other warriors who didn't come to Beowulf's aid, because he says to them, all of those gifts, all of those rewards, all of that land, all of that, you know, you were happy to take it when you lived in comfort, but when it actually came to doing what needed to be done to preserve the good, you failed. You failed in your duty. You abnegated your responsibility as men to uphold that. And so Beowulf fundamentally shouldn't have had to have fought that fight, because it was the duty of the young to carry on what he had managed to achieve originally. You can certainly see in Beowulf's death the Christian author at work on a pagan work. Actually, to be fair, I think Beowulf does a very good job of the author being able to have his cake and eat it too when it comes to this particular story, because he's able to show the Germanic heroism of Beowulf in his fights against Grendel and his mother, to be mighty, to vanquish evil, to fight against foes, and to achieve renown and glory and wealth. But he's also able to end Beowulf's story on a very Christian theme of selflessness and sacrifice, because Beowulf is never going to actually be able to enjoy this wealth that he himself has won, but he knows that it gets to continue on so that other people might enjoy what he cannot have. And obviously the matter of keeping them safe from the dragon's fury, which he ultimately does. And at this point, it feels like an appropriate time to speak about another particularly prescient theme in the work of Beowulf, which is what you could characterize as doom or fate, or as the Anglo-Saxon term would put it, weird, which is not weird as in, you know, the mustache is a bit weird. It's weird as in W-Y-R-D. And this is a very Anglo-Saxon view of the world, but you can see it constantly at work with that throughout the text of Beowulf, where Beowulf fights against Grendel's mother. And Grendel's mother has a few occasions where she's able to slash at Beowulf with a sword, and fortunately his armor protects him, or he's brought to the ground and is able to stand and rise once more, and is ultimately able to finally vanquish yet another foe and live to fight another day. And so, weird, this philosophy of active fate, and it comes from the Anglo-Saxon verb weirthan, which is to become. And weird is the course of events, and the idea that with enough courage one can fight to continue living, but if doom is pronounced and fate is decided, that there's nothing really that can stand against it. However, it's crucial to point out that weird is not necessarily entirely predestination or a predetermined life, because the fact of the matter is that Beowulf was not destined to die fighting the dragon from the moment that he was born. Rather, he made a choice, an obvious one though it may seem, to defend his people, but one in keeping with his character. All Beowulf was doing what he'd done for his entire life. The only thing he knew what to do, perhaps it could be construed as a criticism of Beowulf's character, that he put everything upon himself and always fought the fight, and the fact that Wiglaf, out of an entire company of men, was the only one who ever actually was able to come to Beowulf's aid in the end, represents the fact that because Beowulf was such an effective king and his strength was able to create so many years of peace, that in that peace, his warriors forgot their primary duty and what they had to do. And Beowulf never thought to remind them of what might be necessary one day. Fortunately, he was able to inspire just enough wisdom in Wiglaf so that the Geatish people might triumph. But ultimately, it leaves on this very foreboding note that actually, now that Beowulf is no longer around, the antagonistic rival Swedes will come in and destroy everything. And ultimately, the gold is kind of worthless without the strength of men to defend it and the honor of men to actually challenge forces that rival their strength. But whatever comes in the future after Beowulf's departure from life, as I've taken from the Exeter book, which was a chronicle written from about 950 to 1000 AD, it is still the best thing, since a man may not himself avert his destiny, that he should therefore suffer it well. And by every metric, I would say that that's exactly what Beowulf does. He manages to conquer a beast that, by rights, should have been able to kill him, especially in his old age. And Beowulf's fate, fighting the dragon, is fundamentally intertwined with a concept that Tolkien described as northern courage, which he describes as a creed of unyielding will and is something that is a characteristic of northern European cultures and societies, mostly, of course, Germanic and Scandinavian, but also English as well, by the nature of its incorporation of those peoples and ideas across the centuries of the Anglo-Saxon invasions and the Norse invasions as well. And you can understand why this philosophy would have, although they wouldn't have articulated it quite in that way, it would have not been necessarily a philosophical idea so much as it would have been a subconscious understanding of the reality of life, that the Northmen's struggle is to relentlessly fight against hope, but the glory and the heroism is to fight all the same. And this, on the mythological level, is very much connected to the Norse idea of Ragnarok. Ragnarok is a final battle, an apocalyptic end to the entire world that will eventually lead to the ruin of all. And even if a Viking warrior might die on the field of battle, it might seem to be glorious and eternally happy for him to arrive in the halls of Valhalla so that he can drink and battle forevermore. But ultimately, he's only waiting there for Ragnarok, for the ultimate doom that will destroy all. And so ultimately, the Northern conception of life was all flowing in the direction of an eventual doom. And in that sense, I couldn't help but be reminded, of course, of that famous passage from the German polymath Oswald Spengler, who had the famous passage from Man and Techniques, which is, "We are born into this time and must bravely follow the path to the destined end. There is no other way. Our duty is to hold on to the lost position without hope, without rescue, like that Roman soldier whose bones were found in front of a door in Pompeii, who during the eruption of Vesuvius died at his post because they forget to relieve him. That is greatness. That is what it means to be thoroughbred. The honourable end is the only thing that cannot be taken from a man." And that is exactly the fate of Beowulf, that he is against hope and against any hopes of his own personal survival or longevity, and in the face of his own mortality. He obviously does ironically achieve immortality because of his deeds and heroism, and he will be remembered forevermore And you can certainly see, though I don't want to dwell on it too long because fundamentally this is about Beowulf and not the Lord of the Rings, but you can certainly see how Tolkien took this idea of northern courage against fighting even without hope because of the sheer goodness of fighting against evil, of fighting for survival, and the nobility of such an act. And you can see that being a very prevalent theme within the Lord of the Rings itself, even if Tolkien has his own criticisms of it and doesn't quite agree because of his Catholic metaphysics and his general view of the divinely ordained trajectory of the universe. And whilst I'm speaking about it, of course, it does also make sense just to dwell on a few other obvious parallels between Beowulf and Tolkien's other works, which is, of course, that the way that the dragon is unleashed in Beowulf with the thief sneaking into his halls to steal a jeweled cup, and the dragon waking up in fury and going out and setting ablaze Beowulf's town, is almost beat for beat a copy of exactly what, of course, happens in The Hobbit with Bilbo Baggins sneaking into Erebor, the Lonely Mountain, and stealing a jeweled cup from the dragon Smaug, who then goes on to set fire to Lake Town. And also there is another very, very faithful piece of imagery from Beowulf's funeral towards the end of the story, where within Beowulf's barrow, within his mound, there is a circle of horses that ride around it in procession. And this very, very clearly mirrors the funeral of Théoden, the king of Rohan, towards the end of The Lord of the Rings as well. Another interesting parallel between the two works, not as a particular event, but just more as a commonality of action, is that there is a lack of religious ritual in both of the texts. Now, obviously, in Beowulf, that obviously can be ascribed to the fact that the Christian author doesn't want to illustrate lots and lots of pagan rituals, because what he's trying to do is trying to find Christian virtue in ancestors whose religion he fundamentally disagrees with. And so really, the Beowulf poet is looking specifically for virtue in moral action. And of course, there can be no virtue in the action of other gods and deities. And it's quite interesting, actually, how the Beowulf poet is able to reconcile the pagan past with the Christian presence, because actually when you look at it, you see that he has a lot of fondness and praise for that pagan past. It's in the same vein that Dante in his Inferno, that you have all of those pagan characters and historical figures such as Aristotle and Plato and Socrates, who were born before the revelation or could not know the revelation of Christ, and therefore cannot gain access into heaven, but all the same were regarded by Dante and most people as virtuous and good men who's dedicated their lives to moral instruction and ethics and pontificated upon questions of how to build a good society and maintain good governance, which is exactly the same themes that the text of Beowulf really explores. Just another thought, actually, on the more monstrous aspects of Beowulf is that in the original Old English of the text, on one of the original first pages, where it speaks about how all of these monsters came into the world through their descent from Cain, the poet uses the Old English word Orkneus, which is what is described in Anglo-Saxon as a kenning, which is two words compounded together to create some metaphorical expression. And so Orkneus, as a rough translation, hell corpses. And it's these hell corpses, this Orkneus, that would go on to obviously inspire Tolkien to adopt the word orc for his later very monstrous creatures of his own in Middle-earth. And although we've actually had a very, very good, by my reckoning anyway, very good adaptation of The Lord of the Rings, I'm actually quite frustrated by the fact that we've never had a very faithful, good adaptation of Beowulf that wasn't even made on a shoestring budget or was basically tarnished by some very questionable writing decisions.
I am Beowulf!
Such as they made in the animated film of 2007, in which it seems to be quite the diversion from the original text that rather than killing Grendel's mother, Beowulf actually decides to sleep with her instead. Whoever came up with that decision basically, well, let's just say the project was dead on arrival from that point on. Ultimately, as regards to the original, much like the themes and the characters from the poem, Beowulf's name and legacy have doggedly survived against all odds through the ages, and I think it's rightfully regarded as one of the great cultural treasures of Northern Europe, and it's a very poignant story that speaks to the eternally good virtues of loyalty, kingship, and bravery. And you can see this in the way that all the way from the beginning of the story with this mythical character of Shield, who founded the original Shieldings, to his descendant Hrothgar, and then across the sea as well, across the sound, to Sweden with characters like Hygelac and then Beowulf, that they all exhibit similar qualities of strength that lead to a good society. They all show great, unwavering moral conviction in what is good and what is evil, and what must be done in order to keep evil at bay, which is ultimately to fight it. And it's, as I said earlier on, it's definitely a point of strength to Hrothgar's character that he's willing to entertain the idea of this outsider coming to help him to vanquish this evil. You can see in that sense as well how it also further connects to the Lord of the Rings, because, of course, that is about a collaborative effort between different races of people working together to vanquish things that could be considered absolute evil. Of course, as always, Tolkien puts it best. And if I were to read just one passage from his actual lecture, The Monster and the Critic, it would be this one, which is: the Beowulf author is still concerned primarily with man on earth, rehandling in a new perspective an ancient theme that man, each man, and all men, and all their works shall die, a theme no Christian need despise. Yet this theme plainly would not be so treated, but by the nearness of a pagan time, the shadow of its despair, if only as a mood, as an intense emotion of regret, is still there. The worth of defeated valour in this world is deeply felt. As the poet looks back into the past, surveying the history of kings and warriors in the old traditions, he sees that all glory, or as we might say, culture or civilization, ends in night. The solution of that tragedy is not treated. It does not arise out of the material. We get, in fact, a poem from a pregnant moment of poise, looking back into the pit, by a man learned in old tales who was struggling, as it were, to get a general view of them all, perceiving their common tragedy of inevitable ruin, and yet feeling this more poetically, because he was himself removed from the direct pressure of its despair. And I certainly agree with that. I think that there is a romanticism of former glory that works its way throughout the words of Beowulf. That actually, in being removed from it and from the Beowulf poet looking back, he's able to romanticize these people, romanticize this culture that fundamentally perhaps gave this author his own origin story in a way. His ancestors might have come from those lands. And ultimately, it's the wisdom of the Beowulf poet that he comes away from it knowing that, yes, ultimately, those civilizations, that society, are doomed. And indeed, he actually is entirely exonerated in this view, because ultimately, the pagan world of Northern Europe does fall. Those tribes, such as Beowulf, such as the Geats, do collapse and are conquered by the Swedes, and the pagan Swedes in turn are converted to Christianity. and so much of that world and who they were, and that window into that moment in time disappears into darkness and defeat, and out of it is born something new, just as Anglo-Saxon England brought something new out of their conquest, and so the Normans did in turn against Godwinson after 1066. And so I just think that Beowulf is a really, really important story and a magnificent window into a particular period of history and an area of the world that is very much unlit in those dark ages. And I would very much, for those of you who haven't actually read it, I'd thoroughly recommend it. Tolkien's translation is very, very good, but nonetheless, I felt like it was an appropriate place to begin. And so I hope that you've managed to find some worth in this first episode of Chronicles. I've really enjoyed presenting it, and I shall work very, very hard on honing my craft in presenting it to you, because it's quite a new format, actually. I've never really just spoken to the camera like this before, so hello. And so that's where we'll round off discussion on Beowulf. I hope that it's been informative. I hope that it's been interesting and engaging, and I shall work very, very hard as I settle into this role as host of this show to certainly work on myself as well as a presenter as I communicate it with you and in future episodes. But yeah, I love Beowulf. I think it's a fantastic story, and I hope to see you in the next one. Thank you very much.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.